The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
No need to wave. And we are with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard. Not physically with, but...
Not physically with you.
Over the airwaves.
Over the airwaves. I am physically with Lionel here. Where are we, Lionel?
We are in East London, in not quite the shadow of the Olympic Park, but we're in the old Athletes' Village. The old Athletes' Village dates back to 2012, when everything about Britain
Yield
was great.
The Athletes' Village.
The Olympics were here and everyone was optimistic and unified.
All right.
These were the athletes' apartments, or they certainly were over there, weren't they? And now we are in a cafe called the Hand Cafe.
My first time here. Yeah, they've done a nice job here. It's cool. We were here because we were meeting a cyclist earlier, a secret meeting, a rendezvous with a cyclist who's competing in the London 6 Day. But that's for another time, that conversation. Today.
What, you mean we're not covering the 6 days? We're not covering the indoor cycling?
Well, our indoor cycling correspondent is currently in Mallorca, so difficult to... We can't do everything, Daniel. And we do today have the Tour de France route to discuss. The 2019 Tour de France route was unveiled this morning in the familiar ceremony in Paris, Christian Prudhomme.
It's one of the great things about indoor cycling, isn't it? There's no speculation, no uncertainty about the route. It's always the same, isn't it? It's always the same bloody oval that they just go around again and again. Anyway,
I think we should move on from indoor cycling. Yeah. The Tour de France route presentation is a very familiar spectacle as well, isn't it? A little twist. Have they presented the riders on stage like that before? I can't remember seeing the riders like a low-rent fashion show. Peculiar outfits, I thought.
I mean, it's the world of skinny jeans and kind of Euro fashion, isn't it? I mean, I'm talking here as a middle-aged man who no longer has to even nod in the cursory direction of fashion. So, What do I know?
Who was your standout outfit before we get on to the news roundup? I thought Greg Van Avermaet looked pretty dashing in his cycling t-shirt and suit combo.
No comment.
From my point of view, everyone was eclipsed almost literally by Nasser Bouhanni's sort of gold sort of spandex. No, what's the word I'm looking for? Not spandex. Gold lame boxing boots with a very sort of conservative outfit otherwise, but just these extraordinary sort of ankle high gold boots. Yeah.
Yeah, well, anyway, we'll save that kind of serious stuff for a bit later on. Can you give us a news roundup, please, Lionel? Because besides this, there's been quite a lot going on.
It has. It's been busy. The road season, the World Tour road season has finally ended with the Tour of Guangxi in China. Gianni Moscon of Sky won that after winning the most challenging and the hilliest stage. There are also stage wins there for Dylan Groenewegen and Pascal Ackermann. Matteo Trentin and Fabio Jakobsen of Quickstep won a couple there. There was also the Japan Cup, which is not a World Tour race, but it's kind of, that really is the curtain call of the season, isn't it? The last race on the calendar. Rob Power of Mitchelton Scott won that, ahead of Antoine Tolhoek of Lotto NL Jumbo. And that was Power's last race before he joined Sunweb next season. The women's one-day race there was won by Arlenis Sierra of Astana. She beat Hannah Barnes of Canyon SRAM. The UCI World Tour rankings, therefore, are complete, and Simon Yates has topped the rankings ahead of Peter Sagan, Alejandro Valverde, Geraint Thomas and Greg Van Avermaet. Yates, of course, won the Vuelta, led the Giro for a long time. That's where he clocked up all of those points. Quickstep won the team's classification well ahead of Team Sky. The Women's World Tour was won by Annemiek van Vleuten. Quite a bit of transfer news that's been confirmed. Stefan Denifil of Aqua Blue, who are stopping, of course. He's going to the CCC team, which is the old BMC team, now CCC. Ben Swift is going back to Team Sky from Team UAE. And a transfer we thought was off the cards with Quickstep getting their new sponsorship. Fernando Gaviria is going to Team UAE Emirates. Or UAE Team Emirates, sorry. And finally, on the transfer front, well, it's not a move. Mark Cavendish is staying put at Direct Dimension Data. Daniel may have some intel on that. Off the bike, Stephen de Jong, the Trek Segafredo sports director, gave his loved ones cause for worry when he went for a ride near his home in Girona and didn't come back when he was expected. His wife put out an appeal on Twitter, and some pro riders who live in the area, including Robert Hessink, they formed a search party and went out to look for him. His Strava file had stopped recording about 60 kilometres into the ride, and that enabled the helicopter search team to narrow down where they were looking for de Jong, and he was found unconscious but breathing in a ravine. Really nasty accident for de Jong. Suffered severe concussion and said on Twitter that he hurt all over, but hopefully he is now on the road to recovery. Speaking of sports directors, Johan Bruneel, former sports director of Lance Armstrong's US Postal and Discovery Channel team and Astana back in the day, he's been given a life ban by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, or rather they've upheld that life ban. And Bruneel
issued a 10-year ban, so they've increased it.
So he's now been given a life ban, having been given a 10-year ban, appealed against that, but it's been extended to a life ban. He issued a statement, a kind of slightly rambling statement, really. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, whether we think that's a proportionate punishment for Johan Bruneel, who of course was a sports director throughout all of those now deleted Tour de France victories by Lance Armstrong. He was part of the inner circle when it came to all Armstrong's doping. Indoor cycling, Daniel, the World Cup is back underway. You'll be very excited about this. The first round was at the Paris Velodrome. It's not actually in Paris, it's in Saint-Quentin-en-Yvelines, just to the southwest. Felt a little bit low key, certainly from a British point of view.
It's a young, very young team as well, and the pictures that I saw from there.
Yeah, I watched a bit of it. The outstanding team, really, were the Danes, who won the team pursuit, the men's team pursuit. They caught the British in the final. Lassie Hansen and Michael Merku won the men's Madison.
And I've got to pull you up on your pronunciation there. It's as I established Michael Morkov at the Vuelta. You either pronounce both his names the Danish way, or neither. In which
go
case,
on.
So he introduced himself as Michael Morkov to me. I said, "Oh, Michael Morkov, we've been calling you Merku." He said, "Well, it's like Mihail Merku, if you want to go the whole Danish hog." Oh, sorry, Lionel. I know this has been one of your favourites the last couple of years.
Rules change. The laws just keep changing.
I hope I've got the pronunciation Michael right there.
Anyway, they won the men's Madison, and Amelie Didericsen and Julie Leth won the women's Madison for Denmark. Meanwhile, some outdoor winter cycling. The Cyclocross World Cup has returned to Europe after two rounds in the USA. Matthew van der Poel won the men's race, and Marianne Vos won the women's race. Lots going on.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa, for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. I've been getting some emails from Rafa with some of their new Explorer products and their Explorer range. Really got my heart set on the Explorer down jacket for the winter as it gets a bit chillier. It looks fantastic, and I will be hopefully taking delivery of one of them pretty soon. I'm going to treat myself. Lionel, don't look at me like that, Lionel, suspiciously.
Was that not an absolutely shameless come and give me a jacket?
A little
plea
bit.
To our
a little
sponsors?
Bit. They've gone.
Yeah, it sounds very
hey guys, you've
like
got
it.
My address.
The problem is, it's like having children. You can't send out one Explore jacket. You've got to send out three.
I'm an extra large, if that helps. Anyway, it looks like a cracking range, and it ties in nicely to something we'll be launching very soon. We keep teasing about this, Lionel. Mm. Can we say any more at this stage? Or
no.
No, really?
I don't know.
Maybe next week. Tune in next week for more details about this. But it's very exciting. So, chaps, Tour de France route was announced, as we said earlier today. We'll be asking you for your... Well, Daniel, I'm sure you've been studying the mountains in particular, the summit finishes and so on. But I suppose the major themes were the 100-year anniversary of the yellow jersey. Eugene Christophe was the first man to wear that in 1919. Why a yellow jersey? Does anybody know the actual reason for the yellow jersey.
Is this like the quiz show QI? And if I say, oh, well, it was the pages of the newspaper.
Just think of me as Stephen Fry here.
Sandy Toksvig, I was thinking. If I say, oh, it was the colour of the pages of the newspaper that sponsored / owned the race, are you going to set off some kind of siren?
I'm not, actually, because I'm not even, as with all these stories, there are several different versions of the story. One is that there was a shortage of fabric after the First World War, and a yellow fabric was the only available fabric. But Daniel, you might have another version of this story.
No, because as you say that, I'm getting mixed up between why, in fact, I know that I'm getting confused by the story of why the Gazzetta dello Sport is pink, and that was to do with the shortage of white paper on a particular day in their editorial office in Milan. And I think originally they went with green for... Yeah, they did. They went with green for a while, La Gazzetta, and they eventually settled on pink. And consequently, the race, which was owned by La Gazzetta, settled on a pink jersey. But the yellow jersey, I've got a bit of a blind spot at this very moment. Rich,
our listeners are very educated in the history of cycling. So if there are any other theories out there, but Eugene Christophe, we can agree, was the first man to wear it and didn't like it at all. Felt like he didn't want to look like a canary, he said, and he didn't like the sort of attention it brought him at the time. But it has persisted, obviously, over the last 100 tours. And there'll be a lot of commemorations, I'm sure, next year of that 100th anniversary, as there will be for Eddy Merckx. The race starts in Brussels, and it is exactly 50 years since Eddy Merckx won his first Tour de France in 1969. Very good year, I would have thought, to be an Eddy Merckx biographer, Daniel.
Yeah,
maybe. Can you recommend any good Eddy Merckx biographies, Daniel?
No, I was going to say... I was going to say I can't, but that is probably doing a disservice to our August colleague, William Fotheringham, who wrote a very good one.
Book sales ahoy. So, what are your main takeaways from the route? I mean, the other headlines, I suppose, are Christian Prudhomme lashing out against power meters, and at least the impression that this is a race with fewer... He called it the highest tour ever. I think that's based on the number of summit finishes over 2,000 metres, but there are fewer or category climbs. There are more second category climbs, and it does look as though they're trying to create a slightly more open race.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the route, it's actually quite an unusual map, isn't it? It starts in Brussels, of course, as you said, Rich. That's partly, at least, to mark 50 years since Eddy Merckx's first victory in 1969, and then weaves its way south and into basically trying to seek out pretty much the hilliest terrain in the country. Goes to La Planche de Belfi, where instead of finishing at the what has become a semi-regular finish, first used in 2012 when Froome. Wiggins basically took the race apart there, they're going to use a goat track, a gravelly goat track, following kind of in the footsteps really of the Giro, which has been using gravelly style climbs for probably a decade or so now. Obviously, back in the old days, there were lots of gravelly type roads that the Tour de France would have gone over. And then, of course, it cuts across in a diagonal straight through the Massif Central to the Pyrenees, a time trial in Po, and then across the south and into the Alps at the end, and finishing up in Albertville on the final Saturday before the traditional last stage into Paris and the Champs-Élysées. My initial question was, they're marking 100 years of the yellow jersey, they're marking 50 years of Eddy Merckx's first win, but they're not really marking 20 years of Lance Armstrong's first victory. Selective acknowledgement of history here by the Tour de France. I'm being slightly mischievous, of course.
Daniel, what are your thoughts on the tour route?
Well, Rich, hot takes. More Alps than Pyrenees, more ski than surf, more Burgundy than Bordeaux, more Puff Daddy than
Snoop
Dogg.
He's written this down. That's not off
spontaneous,
the top of his
head.
I guess you want an explanation.
That's fine. Lionel, back to you.
Obvious. more ski than surf. Well, it's very, Christian Prudhomme called it the highest Tour de France ever. I think he was referring to the number of summit finishes over 2,000 metres. So yeah, that's fair enough. Also, not a lot of time spent around the coast. More Burgundy than Bordeaux. So we go to places like Mâcon, very famous for its wine in Burgundy. We completely shun the wine growing region of Bordeaux. And more Puff Daddy than Snoop Dogg. Well, this everyone, of course, will think back immediately to the 1995 Source Awards, when there was a big war between West Coast hip-hop and East Coast hip-hop. And that precipitated the events that precipitated the tragic deaths of Tupac Shakur.
Sorry, Daniel. I think
anyway, basically, I mean that it spends more time in the East. It spends more time in the East than the West. Well, it spends no time in the West. It completely shuns the West this year.
It is. It's a very one-sided Tour de France, isn't
it? Lopsided, yeah. It is.
Yeah, strange to miss out such a huge chunk of the country. Pau is as west as we will get, but it really, when you look at the map, it's an unusual sort of map. And on first impressions, it looks, from a logistical point of view, slightly more straightforward than some recent tours.
Being a bit more serious, Rich, I did expect it to be maybe a little bit more gimmicky than it is. We've talked about this a lot in the last couple of years, the introduction of, well, gravel stages or cobble stages, much shorter stages. Last year we saw one that was just 65 kilometers, another one that was 100 kilometers. There are short stages, short mountain stages in particular in this tour. There's one that's 117 kilometers that finishes on the Tourmalet, another two in the Alps of a similar distance, but I thought they might push it even further. I don't know whether that's to do with the fact that tour routes are, well, they're generally designed about 2 years in advance, not 1 year in advance or several months in advance. So there's not a lot of scope for Christian Prudhomme and ASO to respond to what has happened in the previous year's edition. They're already well ahead with planning the next one. Or whether a decision has been made that last year's ultra short stages didn't work that well. I mean, I was just thinking back to those two stages earlier on, and it occurs to me that, you know, if people didn't know the length of the stages, their memories of those days would not really be altered or influenced in any great shape or in any great way by the fact that they were such short stages. They looked, to all intents and purposes, like normal mountain stages, just a little bit more intense, a little bit more entertaining as far as the viewer was concerned. But, you know, there has been, I think, a decision made that short stages are the way to go to a certain extent, but they're not going to keep getting shorter and shorter.
The thing I most enjoy, I think, about the tour presentation is the look back on the previous tour. I keep wanting to call it the previous year's tour. It seems like so long ago, but this year's tour, and really reliving some of the moments of that race. And when you watch the highlights, and of course they've been selected by ASO, there was quite a big emphasis in the highlights on the cobbled stage, which produced such drama and a very emotional win for John Degenkolb. There were other moments, you know, Philippe Gilbert's crash, some footage of him actually in the ravine, which I hadn't seen at the time, and the gridded start, of course, which was a bit of a damp squib. They didn't show it. They didn't show the point at which.
Incredible! I was very disappointed to see no grid start. I thought all the stages were going to be grid starts this year after the roaring success of last year.
But when they didn't linger on that footage long enough to see Luke Rowe move from the back to the front in the first couple hundred meters. But that wasn't a great success. But given that, you know, that cobbled stage did serve up such drama last year, that, as you say, or this year rather, as you say, Daniel, no real gimmicks or, you know, stages like that to whet the appetite, with off-road sections, cobbled sections, there's no gridded start. There's nothing quirky, really, it looks like, on the face of it, perhaps other than that new finish at La Planche des Belles Filles, but that just adds an extra bit of climbing to the stage.
And I think the announcement that there will be time bonuses at different points along the route, potentially on climbs as well, which might tease people out to race slightly differently. I think this is, we've done this, since we started the podcast, haven't we? We've done our snap reaction to the Tour de France route, and in common with my kind of dislike of speculation, I've said this before, so I won't labour this point, but I do think that the whole theatre of the Tour de France route unveil needs a massive revamp, because very, very little about this route was any surprise to me this morning when the yellow line whizzed around France on ASO's presentation. And that's because, well, a number of years ago now, a guy who runs a website called VeloWire put together some serious kind of sleuthing and journalistic skills to pretty much piece together the Tour de France route by scouring the websites of local newspapers in France and digging up information here and there, and has done a very good job for, I would say, coming up to a decade now of spoiling Christmas for us in a way. He's not the only one. I mean, there is a thirst for the rumour of what the route might entail, but I think it's lost something in the big reveal. And I was watching it on the train into London today. It's all very familiar. I think I first went to the Tour de France route presentation 20 years ago in 1999, and very little has actually changed about the way the route is unveiled. And that my first point is that perhaps that needs a bit of a shake-up.
Napalm, when you were a child many years ago, did you used to rummage around in your parents' wardrobe and under their bed for Christmas presents in the days leading up to Christmas?
Did you always know
where the piece of coal and satsuma were hidden and deliberately avoided those areas?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question, because no, I didn't actually. And also, when presents were put under the tree, I didn't go and shake boxes and feel the packaging and try and guess.
Lionel's Chris's presents were revealed on VeloWire in the weeks leading leading up to Christmas
as a slideshow, and I'd just click. I mean, the internet wasn't invented when I was a child, you fool. but I do think that, you know, as I've been pondering this, and people, you see the snap reaction to the route. Oh, it's same old. Oh, it looks like a Jean-Marie LeBlanc tour with a week of, you know, a team time trial and a week of sprint stages and then into the climbs and the mountain. I mean, the geography of France is restricted to the geography of France, for
Nevertheless, Lionel, one thing I've suggested jokingly is a Tour de France with no high mountains. Mm. I mean, this isn't that, you know, but this is clearly an attempt, isn't it? I mean, this is the way the Tour has been going. It's an attempt to favour the French riders, the Bardets, the Barguils, Pinot maybe, Alaphilippe, these guys, no?
I don't know, Rich. I mean, I think the commodity that they aim for most of all, over and above everything else, is suspense now. And I think that they trim and they tweak until they've got a route which they think is going to deliver suspense on the in the last week. And, you know, obviously you can't control that to a huge extent. And in a way, it's the riders and the teams themselves that have created that suspense by riding in a quite defensive way or quite conservative way over the last few years. And we have had generally major tours which have been open going into the last two or three days. But I don't know to what extent they're looking at, you know, Bardet's characteristics. And certainly after the tour that he rode this year, where he's kind of slipped out of the circle of likely winners, I would say, this year. I think there'll be slightly less hype, regardless of how well his early season goes in 2019. I think he's slipped out of the sort of top three, four, five names of palpable winners.
Yeah, I was going to say, Rich, before I was launching into my my monologue about sort of the modern world, if we want to put it that way, I think that we're under kind of a pressure to declare whether it's a good route or a hard route or which riders will it suit. I think the last 6-7 years have shown us that the Tour route suits Team Sky, no matter what you do with it. And I can't see a great deal changing between now and next July to suggest any different. I think that it's not so much the geographic sense of where the race goes. It's more, I think if time bonuses were to, you know, maybe be a little, you know, a factor that would shake things up and change the way the race is ridden. I don't think you can change the way the race is ridden, you know, by looking at the geography of it. The Tour de France will be the Tour de France for another 100 years, and the flavour of it, the sense of it, will be broadly the same. Some years they will experiment a bit more than others. What I look forward to really is that sense of suspense as the race goes on. I mean, there is a lot of climbing. You know, it's pretty much climbing all the way from La Planche de Belfie with a couple of exceptions. They've tried to make it, you know, a race that will, again, on paper, be harder to control, perhaps. You know, a long stretch through the massive Central there, and then a time trial that may or may not, you know, prove decisive, but because it's kind of in the middle of the race, it's not going to be, it's not going to loom in the way that we've seen in the past, where you know it either confirms the winner or the race hinges on it. It's quite interesting in that sense.
Just on the mountains, Napalm, a general point in regard to what Prudhomme said about it being the highest Tour de France ever, how high is this tour compared to other tours? A couple of years ago, we spoke quite a lot about that year's Giro, 2016 Giro, being the Grand Tour. Well, it equaled the record of times over 2,000 metres. It went over 2,000 metres 10 times. This Tour de France is going to go over 2,000 metres 7 times, which is a lot for the Tour de France. But as well as height, I also pay more and more attention these days to the length of the climbs, particularly having covered the Vuelta the last couple of years. I've just become aware of how different the Vuelta has become with the length of the climbs, and riders, you hear riders these days talk a lot about the length of efforts. And in a way, I think the three Grand Tours in their nature are diverging more and more. So you've got the Vuelta at one end of the scale with very, very short and steep climbs, and at the other end of the scale is the Giro with very long climbs, and then the Tour is right in the middle. I just looked at climbs over 10 kilometres, and there were only seven first or special category climbs over 10 kilometres in the whole Vuelta last year. In the Tour next year, there are going to be 12, and the Giro route is going to be announced next week on Wednesday, but that route has already been pretty much leaked in its entirety as well. And I think there are going to be 15 climbs of over 10 kilometres in the last week alone in the Giro. So that shows you how different the races are, and you know that is obviously a factor when you come to look at the contenders. I think the Vuelta last year, there were probably 10 riders we thought who could win the Vuelta before the race started, but I think, you know, what we've seen over the last few years, the guys who can recover well and perform well time and time again on the long climbs, there are probably only 3, 4, 5 of them.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Sponsoring this week's episode, ShipStation. ShipStation, America's number one e-commerce shipping software, is now available in the UK. If you're selling online and you want to get your orders out quickly and keep your customers happy, that's where ShipStation comes in. Lionel, you're a man with customers. You use this.
Yeah, I have. I went to ShipStation.com and I signed up. I entered the promotion code cycling. Basically, if you sell online from eBay or Amazon, or maybe you sell stuff from your own website as I do, I sell books. So I hooked up my Squarespace website to ShipStation pretty simply. I'm really terrible at this kind of thing, you know, technological stuff gets me quite frustrated, but I found it quite easy to just follow the steps through and get it all working. And then you basically have a choice of all of the couriers in one place, so you don't have to go shopping around for the best pickup time or the best price. Royal Mail, Hermes, Amazon Fulfillment, DHL, FedEx and UPS, among other of the well-known couriers, are all on ShipStation. And once you've chosen how you want to dispatch your consignment, in my case it was a couple of cases of books going to a wholesaler, printed out the labels, stuck the labels on, and Bob's your uncle. They got delivered, and it really kind of cut down the number of steps it takes to get a consignment sent out. So I was a happy customer.
Well, try ShipStation free for 30 days, plus get a special bonus when you use the promotion code cycling. To take advantage of this offer, just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in cycling. That's ShipStation.com, then enter the promotion code cycling. ShipStation.com, get ship done.
Very carefully said.
I've been joined on the line by our very own Francois Thomaso. How are you, Francois?
Not too bad, can't complain.
Good, well, it's nice to have you back with us briefly, just for some reaction to the Tour de France route. I mean, one of the headlines was Christian Prudhomme coming out quite strongly against power meters. You've been around a bit, I don't mean to insult you, but have power meters really changed racing, do you think? And is this just a headline from Prudhomme, or is this something he can do to really affect this?
Well, as you know, it's been in discussion for quite a while. I mean, as you know, Christian Prudhomme has always been pretty close to Marc Madieu and these guys. He probably belongs to the old school camp, you know, who believes that, well, you re- remember for the ear equipment and all the problems in the past. I mean, you know, he was behind the ban among others, but he was among the guys who were against any form of device, you know, helping the riders during the race, you know, thinking that riders should ride on instinct. So, and you also remember probably last year in the Vuelta, was it last year or 2 years ago? I think it was 2 years ago. But anyway, it's always the same problem. The Spanish press were very, very, it was kind of a, you know, made up controversy, but still saying guys like Contador or even the Spaniards in general try to ride, you know, on instinct and following their feelings and sensations, you know, where Chris Froome and Team Sky and others, they claim ride with their eyes glued on their power meters. So my opinion on that is I have none. I think power meters are great for training, and I tend to agree with the fact that they might be responsible. What we hear, and it might be true, is that these days, with all the guys, you know, racing with their eyes on their power meters, when they reach their limit, like they reach 420 watts or whatever, you know, they tend to think, oh, I can get any faster. So they tend to kind of curb themselves, and you know, they don't. When in the old days they would have maybe have attacked on feeling, you know, on instinct, and trying to feel their body, and you know, they tend to not to do it anymore. And in a way, you know, some guys think that maybe the reason why we don't see blistering attacks in the mountains anymore is because. Well, you know, the guys don't trust their feelings and don't listen to their body, but you know, stick and obey what the power meter says. So is that true or wrong? There might be a little bit of this. Can you stop technological evolution? It's so difficult to say. In tennis, for instance, you know, coaching is something that's forbidden. Like, you know, you're not supposed to talk to your coach or even look at him or her during play, because you're your own man or girl on the court. Going along the same idea, that the rider should be himself, you know, by himself on the bike without any exterior help. Mm. And maybe power meters can be considered, you know, exterior help or coaching. It's a tricky one. To ban them all together is crazy. They're a great device to use in training. The riders should be asked, you know, whether it affects the way they ride or not, because I don't think Piston Prudhon or myself really know.
It's a subject we are going to return to, and we're going to seek some opinions from people in the sport over the next week, certainly. I mean, briefly on that, there have always been calculating riders, haven't there, from Anquetil to Indurain. They've ridden as if they've had power meters. You know, there's just a certain style of riding, I suppose. And it leads on to, you know, one of the points you made at the Tour de France this year was that the course is secondary to the basic fact of Grand Tour and Tour de France racing, is that climbers don't generally win. It's an exceptional year when a climber wins a Grand Tour. It's generally time trialists who win Grand Tours. You know, this course looks like one designed for, well, in particular, a group of French riders. What's your reaction to the course? How does it compare to previous years?
It looks a lot like Christian Prudhomme, I think. I think it's good because it's a perfect blend of what Christian Prudhomme and his staff are looking for. Because in the state, it's very classical. We're going to Izoard, Galibier, Tourmalet, Iseran. So, you know, the very famous and traditional classic climbs. We're going to towns like, you know, Saint-Étienne or Pau. I mean, all of this is familiar. You know, most places we're going to are kind of familiar. And so that's the old school Christian Prudhomme. And at the same time, there's the tendency to have shorter stages, especially in the mountains. So that's nice. And also, that there's this balance. Is, you know, Prudhomme is really looking for well, to have more mountain stages in the Vosges or in the Massif Central. So he said himself that he thought he had struck the right balance between the four massifs. So in this way, yeah, the stages in the, especially this, well, look at the Planche des Belles Filles has now become a classic, you know, thanks to Prudhomme. It's obviously a mountain he likes very much. Remember that he used to spend his holidays there when he was a young guy. So maybe that's the emotional, you know, cycling loving boy, you know, choosing to go get back there. I think it's going to be intriguing, the stage to Saint-Etienne and all the stages in the Massif Central. As you say, the finish in Brioude is obviously a nod to Romain Bardet. It also looks like Prudhomme because he doesn't like time trials. He always said he wasn't a great fan of time trials. So he's still, you know, he's true to his desire to have fewer time trials and in the tour. As we've seen in the past, it's, even when you have fewer time trials, you still don't really have climbers winning the tour. So will it affect the outcome of the race this year? To be honest, as you say, we have Romain Bardet in Brioude, we have the Vosges and La Planche des Belles Filles with Thibaut Pinot. We have a finish in Foix where Warren Barguil won a stage. Is it really designed for French riders? I think if you really look at the course, it's another one for Team Sky, isn't it? And probably Froome. So if I had to name a favorite on the basis of the course, I'm afraid it would be Froome or Geraint Thomas or Bernal. But I think Team Sky will again be the team to beat. The one who probably doesn't like the course would be Tom Dumoulin with so little time trial in there.
Before we carry on looking ahead to the Tour de France next year, tomorrow we've got a special treat coming for people, something a little bit different. Calvert Churchill and Kira McVitie, who've been keeping the Espoir Diaries for us this year for Friends of the Podcast. And by the way, the final installment of the Espoir Diaries will be released next week. And it's really good. But they also went off to the Red Hook Criterium, the fixed wheel criterium in Milan recently. And they've produced an episode that we've called the cycling podcast No Breaks. And it captures some of the flavour, the atmosphere of Red Hook in Milan. It's a scene that some of you will be familiar with and others will not be familiar with at all. But it's kind of in vogue. People are talking about, I suppose, alternative types of races at the moment, because Education First announced a few weeks ago they'll be running an alternative calendar next year, and some talk of perhaps some of their riders doing events like Red Hook as well as some of the more unconventional races on the alternative calendar, the alt calendar.
Yeah, I wonder what Daniel makes of people riding indoor bicycles outdoors.
I'm not against it. I'm not averse to it, I don't think. But hang on, say that again. Riding outdoor bikes indoors or the other way around?
No, indoor bikes outdoors.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, basically track bikes.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever floats your boat, yeah, fine.
Well, that's coming tomorrow, the cycling podcast No Breaks. So do have a listen to that. And thanks to Calvert and Kira for putting that together. They've done a really nice job. It's been produced and edited by Tom Wally, who has been nominated for an award, one of our several brilliant producers that we have working on the cycling podcast. And Tom's been nominated for award, I think, for the episode he produced last year, that was my day at in the Cannondale team car at the Tour de France, which they captured some of the drama and excitement of that day. But yeah, that's coming tomorrow. Speaking of cycling, Daniel, yeah. you were teasing me this week about a recent exploit of yours in Mallorca, where you seemed to beat my didn't even know. I mean, I think I've done about two rides in my life on Strava, and that must.
And that
be
was one of
them.
Your best performances. That was one of your.
I can't remember the
your best days
the
on
context,
the bike.
But you 5 minutes you put into
about a 5 kilometer climb. So you know, I think your time was
what climb? What climb was it? Which one's that?
Well, what do you mean? Which one's that? It goes. Yeah. Well, what do you want? Do you want grid references? The one that goes out of Bunyola. Do you know Bunyola? And then it goes to Orient.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
Oh, yeah. I do know that climb, yeah.
You're
yeah.
Tell me, you
I remember
there.
Going
you
up that
remember?
Really,
yeah,
really slowly.
Yeah.
I just took it easy up there. Anyway, back to the Tour de France. Somebody who didn't seem to be there, unless I miss him, Tom Dumoulin. Was he at the presentation? Anybody see Tom Dumoulin?
He's just got married, hasn't he?
Will he be
got married the other day.
Oh, I didn't know that. Did not know that. Well, will he be slightly disappointed with his tour route? Not much time trialing for him to do his thing. He has suggested that he will focus on the Tour de France next year. Does it matter? I mean, you know, when you see the ride he did at the World Championships, at the Tour this year, at the Giro, obviously time trialing is what he's best at, but he's pretty good in the mountains as well. I mean, I think regardless of the route, and it kind of goes back to the point you were making, Lionel, regardless of the route, he's got to be one of, if not the favourites for next year, if you look at the trajectory that he's on.
Yeah, definitely. If you finish runner-up in two Grand Tours in the same year, then he is undoubtedly in the list of the A category of favourites. Whether or not he would look at that and think, he'd prefer a few more time trialing kilometres, possibly he would. But then, you know, the sorts of riders that he's going to be up against are also good at time trialing. I mean, the people that may be a bit more pleased that there is relatively little time trialing will be the pure climbers. And in that sense, the balance is good, I think. You know, there's nowhere where people are going to lose, you know, fistfuls of time before heading into the serious business in the Alps in the final week.
I think almost a more interesting question, Rich, and more relevant to Tom Dumoulin's chances is who Sky decide to get behind. Chris Froome or Geraint Thomas, or do they decide to get behind both of them again like they did ostensibly this year? I mean, we know that both of them are getting to the end of the sort of life cycle of a Grand Tour challenger, and usually the drop-off at that age can be quite sudden. We saw that with Miguel Indurain in 1996. Everyone was absolutely certain that he would win another one, and he came nowhere near in 1996. The same the next year with Bjarne Riise, the 1996 champion, came back in 1997 at a similar age. I think he was 32, and again was nowhere. And that can happen at that age. So Sky will have to be careful that they do sort of back the right horse if they do decide to only anoint one of them. I mean, what do you think is likely to happen on that front?
Well, I think Egan Bernal will be in the team and may well be their best bet. I mean, I was stunned to see him back at Il Lombardia so soon after that terrible crash at San Sebastian, where he really damaged his face and teeth terribly. Back racing aggressively, you know, tackling descents like nothing had ever happened. That really just said more than the physical strength that we know he has. I mean, clearly very, very gifted. But when somebody has a really horrible crash like that, you do wonder, will the effects of that be long lasting? And what, a couple of months later, and he's back and, you know, taking the same risks again. And I think, you know, the Francois kind of was being deliberately contrary when he talked about Sky kind of using Bernal as a workhorse during the mountain stages of this year's tour. But I think that experience will stand him in good stead. He'll no longer be a debutant. It will no longer be all new for him. And he may be, still very young, he may be ready to step out of the shadows.
They've got some difficult decisions to make, Sky, really, about next year and what they do, because they've got the Giro to defend as well. Froome is not going to go back there. He's certainly focused on, you know, matching that record of 5 Tour wins. Geraint Thomas is going to want to go back to Tour to defend his title. Egan Bernal, you know, it might be that they save him for the Vuelta, but as you say, Lionel, having put him in the Tour team this year, I can't see them not putting him in the Tour team next year. It would be sort of cutting off your nose to spite your face to not have him in that team. But I think it would be at the Vuelta that he would be leading the team, perhaps. But at the Tour, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't see Geraint Thomas winning the Tour again, but then I couldn't see him winning the Tour the first time. So I think it's, and it goes back to a point that I've made a lot, that for all that, you know, that having the strongest team only really matters if you've also got the strongest rider. You don't win the Tour de France just by having the strongest team. You also need to have the strongest rider. And every time they've won the Tour, Sky, they have had the strongest rider. The real interesting point will come next year if Dumoulin, say, is stronger. You know, Primoz Roglic as well is another guy who you look at his trajectory and you think there's still there's still room for improvement there. You still feel he's getting better. There will come a point where there's a rider in the race stronger than Team Sky's leader. And at that point, I don't think the strength of Team Sky collectively will matter. And that could come next year, but I have a sort of suspicion that Chris Froome will still be capable of winning the Tour next year. Maybe for the last time. I think his decline will come. It might come after next year, I suspect.
And I do think, Rich, as well, that the altitude is going to be a factor. We don't know, and we'll probably explore and talk to people, talk to coaches and so forth over the next few months to find out a bit more about who is likely to cope better with the altitude. But, I remember that Giro in 2016 when they did go over 2,000 metres 10 times, and what a big topic of conversation it was among the teams. And I remember Esteban Chavez, who led that Giro and looked as though he was going to win it until the final day. He talked a lot about how he was favoured by and the number of high altitude climbs. And you think of a climb like the Isérons, so that's the highest pass in Europe, 2,770 metres, right at the back end of the race. And riders tend to say that the altitude, you begin to feel the effects of altitude over 2,000 metres. Well, that's another almost hour of climbing, or the best part of an hour of climbing after 2,000 metres. So it's going to be a huge factor on that day. And there will be some guys who will struggle and who will not enjoy that at all.
But all this is speculation, isn't it? And you know my views on speculation. What we do know is that in a sort of culinary and cultural sense, there's plenty to keep us entertained. I'm looking forward to Francois Tomazot's French flavour as we go round. Well, we don't go round France, do we? We sink to the bottom and then climb halfway back up again. But in the first week, I'm looking forward to a night in Epernay or possibly Reims, which are, of course, the two great homes of Champagne. Then Quiche Lorraine in Nancy. And then, Richard, after La Planche de Belfie, will we be staying in Lure again, which is where we stayed in the peculiar house with the German owner who basically lit a wild bonfire as a barbecue. We didn't like the look of that.
Well, you notice that as he pointed to the fire that he'd lit for the barbecue and tried to whet our appetites for it. You notice he was missing a finger and became convinced that he'd actually chopped off his finger in preparing the meat for the barbecue. And so you decided that we shouldn't risk the barbecue, went into town, had a terrible meal in town instead, came back to find our colleagues from Le Monde sort of purring and patting their stomachs, having enjoyed what they said was a delicious barbecue. So that was an error. But no, we'll try not to go back to Lure.
Well, this is a story from our book, isn't it? A Journey Through the Cycling Year.
Christmas present.
Yeah, one or other of us documented present. That particular night. Daniel, you mentioned Mâcon, some great wines around there, and then heading all the way towards Cassilet area, two great towns of Cassilet, Toulouse and Foix. Spread out this year.
Via Lionel, one of my favourite wine growing regions of France, but not very well known, the Costillon de Nîmes. We enjoyed some of that at the Vuelta when the Vuelta started in Nîmes last year, but I'm looking forward to that again.
Well, we haven't got there yet. We've got to go through the Pyrenees and Francois' little hideaway.
Of course, sorry, Nîmes comes after the Pyrenees. Sorry, yep.
It does. Yeah, don't worry. It's all right. I mean, you could probably cut across and we'll meet you there. But
I mean, from a cycling point of view, some interest. St. Etienne, of course, the scene of Bernardino's crash in 1985. Also, the place where Dave Brailsford went to try and become a professional cyclist, St. Etienne, as a young man. Albi, where Alexander Vinokourov won a famous time trial in 2007, was it? And where he was bandaged up.
Yeah, Michael Rasmussen. I've got a story about that I'll tell next year.
Toulouse, where Mark Cavendish won a stage in 2008. That was the last time the Tour went to Toulouse. And Nîmes, not a Tour de France, story, but the Vuelta, of course, started there last year. And it was a fantastic place. And it was interesting to hear Prudhomme reference that, because... okay, the tour's not starting there, but as a town, it was a great host for a bike race on that occasion.
Yeah, and the following day, the stage will start at Pont du Gard. And, I mean, if you've never been there or seen it, it's a stunning two-story aqueduct across the river, Roman aqueduct. I remember, I went on holiday there when I was about 8 years old and remember, I don't think I've been back in the 35 years since then. So I'm looking forward to seeing the Pont du Gard again. And then up into the Alps for not far off, a good half week of melted cheese. Excellent.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
So the question this week for Dr. Rob Child at Science and Sport is from Sun Krau Hansen from Denmark, who asks about the window post-exercise, the open window to the muscles after training during the first 30 minutes. This idea that the window for optimal refueling for starting recovery is the first 30 minutes after finishing exercise. How much effort does it take to keep that window open? How much effort does it take to open or reopen that window?
Thanks for that question. It's quite an interesting one. First thing to point out is the actual optimal window for recovery isn't just the first 30 minutes. It actually extends for several hours after exercise. But in the first 30 minutes, you should focus typically to provide about 20 grams of protein and 30 to 40 grams of fast digesting carbohydrate. Then for the next 3.5 hours, you should aim to consume about 60 to 80 grams of fast digesting carbohydrates per hour. And this should take the form of white rice, white pasta, white bread, or even noodles, for example. The so-called recovery window corresponds to a time period when the muscle's ability to repair is increased, as is its ability to store carbohydrate in the form of glycogen. This situation actually changes over time, and after several hours, the ability to repair and refuel damaged muscles is reduced. There's actually no way to reopen the recovery window after exercise. So it's very important to optimise protein and carbohydrate intake, especially in the first 4 hours.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Sun Krau Hansen for your question to Rob Child at Science in Sport. We've got lots more questions coming up in the next few weeks. Some really interesting ones, actually. And if you have a question for Science and Sport, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And thank you to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. Slightly awkward segue there from Lionel talking about eating lots of cheese in the Alps into the Science and Sport message, but you know, it's all food, it's all fuel, isn't it?
Cheese flavoured energy gel.
That's your fuel. That's your fuel.
Yeah, a raclette flavoured energy gel.
Lionel Burney, fueled by cheese. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Let's mention our show in Cardiff, because our show in London at the Clapham Grand on November the 12th has sold out. The last few remaining tickets went on sale on Friday and sold out. So really looking forward to that, and hopefully we'll be able to record it on the night, so we'll be able to release it in some form or other. We're working on that, but really looking forward to it. Got two mystery guests on the night as well. But we are doing a show a couple of weeks later in Cardiff on November the 27th at St David's Hall, and there's still about 30 tickets left for that, I believe.
30,
something like that.
Maybe 40. At
30
push,
or 40. Yeah. So if you go to thecyclingpodcast.com live events, you'll be able to buy tickets through that site. And as I mentioned already, we've got a Friends of the Podcast episode coming out next week with Calvert Churchill and Kira McVitie. That's the final installment of the Espoir Diaries. And one more Friends special to come out this year in a few weeks. We'll give you details of that soon. We've covered the tour, I think, for 2019. No more speculation, but some hard news this week with, well, I guess the biggest story happened overnight with Mark Cavendish confirming that he will stay with Dimension Data after rumours of him leaving Bahrain Merida was mentioned. There have been some issues at the team, and he will have a new role at the team as on the sort of management group. Daniel, do you know much more about how this has come about?
Not a huge amount, Rich. We spoke a few weeks ago, didn't we, about how, well, this was a big surprise because as far back as the spring, Cavendish was pretty emphatic about the likelihood of him leaving the team, and negotiations weren't really going anywhere. And since the announcement that he was still suffering from the Epstein-Barr virus in the late summer, they've got together again, started talking again, and the Bahrain thing That fell through. And yeah, he's back for another year. I mean, I know that he certainly, well, I don't think it's any secret that he would like to be involved in managing a team when he finishes his career, whenever that might be. Whether that is going to be the same structure as his current Dimension Data team, we didn't know, but this is a pointer in that direction, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, Daniel. And I mean, the fact is that he still presumably thinks he can do plenty on the bike. I mean, it's baby steps back into training for him at the moment, I think. But and his recovery from Epstein-Barr, you know, it sometimes isn't as straightforward as just recovering from a cold or something. It's a serious virus that can linger. So it remains to be seen just, you know, how he goes in the early part of next year. But he must still think that he can get close to that record that Eddie Merckx holds of the 34 Tour stage wins. I mean, he's four adrift at the moment of equaling it, five adrift of breaking it. But if he didn't think he could do that, he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't have the motivation to carry on. And the fact that he's staying at Dimension Data, and well, all of his entourage are staying as well. If there's been a wrestling for control in that team, well, Mark Cavendish has kind of won it, hasn't he?
I haven't seen him publicly say that he's going for, that he wants that record. It's a very un-Cavendish thing to do, but he did say that in the team's own press release, that's his big remaining goal. You know, for somebody who always says that winning one stage of the Tour is enough, I was quite surprised to see him state that quite so explicitly.
Just on the subject of renewing contracts, chaps, what is this? What is this American?
Yeah, it's in the post, Daniel. Okay, I mean, it should.
What is this American verb to re-up? I'm just reading reports now. I'm reading stories about the Cavendish deal. American websites talking about him re-upping. Do you approve of that, Napalm?
No.
I don't approve of...
Glad we cleared that up.
Well,
the other one,
when somebody re-signs and they don't hyphenate it, so it says they've resigned Mark Cavendish resigns. I mean, I can understand where re-up would come from as an alternative to getting it being unclear with re-sign, resign.
Something else I object to is recon. Over recce for reconnoiter, reconning. Mm. Everybody talks about reconning now. I don't approve of that.
Reccing is a sort of military phrase, though, isn't it? Really, at heart.
Anyway, enough of that. Fernando Gaviria to UAE. Daniel, you said when we talked about the new sponsorship at Quickstep and you know, securing the future of the team and allowing Patrick Lefebvre to keep his roster of riders together, you said that you thought Gaviria may still go to UAE, and so it has proved. On a three-year contract, I think it'll be really interesting to see how he gets on there, because it's not a team where riders have tended to go and got better. A few examples of quite the opposite happening. You know, it's the old Lamprey team, isn't it, effectively? And it was similar as Lamprey, where riders went and generally didn't get better or got worse. Whereas at Quickstep, the opposite appears to happen. And so Gaviria, a rider really at the top of his game, I think it'll be really, really interesting to see how he gets on there and whether he can be the man to revive that team's fortunes.
I think Patrick Lefebvre is playing some kind of elaborate seasons-long game of chicken.
But he's great at getting rid of sprinters, isn't he? Bringing on sprinters, you know, they enjoy great success and then they leave. I mean, just look at that team, you know, Kittel, Cavendish. Cavendish had one really good year of Dimension Data at the Tour de France, but he's never let somebody go and they've gone on to perform better, I don't think. You could correct me if I'm wrong.
Gaviria could be the exception to that rule, but I mean, I'm starting to think that even I could put on a Quickstep skin suit and win a couple of stages.
I don't think you could even put on a Quickstep skin suit.
it would be a squeeze.
Let alone win a race.
It'd be a wriggle at the moment.
It will be very interesting, chaps, see how he does. Not least because I think we've touched on this before this year, that just when you talk to people about Gaviria, I've sensed certainly a bit of a note of caution when some of his, well, people who have admired him and admired his emergence over the last two or three years, they You know, they talk about how he needs to keep his feet on the ground, and it just has sounded at times as though some alarm bells have been starting to ring for whatever reason. You know, whether it's the pressure of fame and celebrity, or you know, things to do with his lifestyle. I have no, you know, privileged information on this whatsoever, so maybe I'm imagining things, but you know, taken out of that context, the Quick Step team, which was just, you know, everyone was enjoying great success there, everyone was winning, it didn't seem to matter who you put into that system, into a context which well, it is not enjoying the same success, and some riders have not move forward in their career, on the contrary, when they've moved to that team. It's going to be interesting to see what trajectory Gaviria takes over the next few months, certainly.
Well, lots to look forward to. And as the rider that we, the mystery rider who we met earlier here in this very cafe, Lionel, said, the new season is almost upon us. Mm. There's very little opportunity for riders to take much of a break now. And he is getting on with training, working hard for next season. Just yep. Finally, before we go, we didn't mention La Course by the Tour de France, which got a mention from Christian Prudhomme. It's been rejigged again for 2019. We'll be covering this in much greater detail on the cycling podcast Femina in the November episode. But it's last year's sort of mountain stage is now... It's now something else. It's a long circuit race in Poets. They're using the time trial circuit. They're doing five laps. It's about 120 kilometer road race, and again, difficult to know whether that is a step forward, a step back, a step sideways. It's you know, I think they're looking for a competitive race. I think it was a brilliant race last year, but those two, Annemiek van Vleuten and Anna van der Breggen, are really head and shoulders above everybody else at the moment, and maybe they're wanting something a bit more open next year. We'll see if that happens, but details of La Course tend to come out a little bit later on in terms of timings and so on. You know, will the time trial on that day perhaps start a little bit later, allowing the women to ride at least in the middle of the day, or will it be a very early start and the race finish as it did this year, long before the time trial gets underway? We don't know yet, but I'm sure we'll find out. It's changing again. I'm sure there'll be a range of views as to the changes for next year, and we'll try and canvas some of them for the next cycling podcast Femina. But in the meantime, I think that's us for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.